The one thing about geese is that they'll recognize when they have the upper hand, and at that point they show no mercy. The typical situation with a child, the child becomes frightened and doesn't stand his ground, and so as they run away, then the goose recognizes that he has won the contest and takes, I'm sure, sheer delight in chasing the child off at breakneck speed.
Hello, this is your host, Patty Kostelic. I'm back from vacation. As you know, I've been gone a few weeks, and I understand I missed some very nice programs. When I called Carla Tonella, our producer, up this morning to check that everything was fine, she said, yes, I have some very special guests for you today, and she did. I thought she was kidding. I have two roosters here. Really, I do. I thought that it was a joke. I thought that she was just trying to make me feel good. I've just come back from Mexico. Everyone has a few chickens down there, and I thought she wanted me not to feel so bad that I've come back to 30 below, two frozen cars. My plumbing does not work, and I thought she wanted just to make me feel good. It turns out that we have hundreds of people in Fairbanks that are poultry enthusiasts. I have three in the studio with me this evening, Peter and Helen Marshall, Sue Corte, who is an APRN reporter and works out of KUAC here and also a poultry enthusiast, and Ken Krieg, who is a statewide livestock specialist with the Cooperative Extension Service. When I was talking to some people today in my travels around the university, it turns out that a lot of people know a lot about poultry, do raise poultry in the Fairbanks area. If some of you are listening and if you have friends who are interested in poultry, I hope you'll call them up and tell them to tune in. This should be a very interesting evening. You have a lot to say.
We'll try to keep it quiet.
That's all right. He's kind of interesting.
This is one of our hens. It's the it's a barred rock, and barred rocks are black and white, and they're one of the better breeds. Ken is probably pretty good at that. One of the better breeds for Alaska. That and the other one we have here is a Rhode Island Red rooster. He's in captivity right now over there. He doesn't look like he's making much noise, but he's also in the studio.
He's sort of being held in the arms like a baby on his back.
Yes, that's my husband right there.
Very tranquil. Very tranquil looking. That was very interesting when I told Jim Cole at the Health Center that I was having two chickens for guests tonight. He said immediately, what kind? Now that seems to be a relevant issue. Ken, can you tell us about some kinds and what would make them better for Alaska, as Sue just mentioned, or worse, and how many varieties there are?
Sure. The thing I guess you need to decide first is, why do you want chickens? And basically I think they fall into about three categories. If you're looking for egg layers, there are breeds that are specific for egg layers. If you want meat producers, there are breeds, of course, for that. And a lot of poultry enthusiasts just simply like to have them as ornaments, in a sense, or pets. So it kind of depends on your goals.
For company.
If you are looking at egg layers, in the lower 48, in warmer climates, we generally are looking at Leghorns or Leghorn cross. They're kind of like a dairy cow from the standpoint that they're very heavy producers. If you're looking for very heavy egg production, Leghorns are a good choice. The problem with Leghorns in Alaska is that unless you're in a very controlled climate, they don't stand the cold very well. And so, and like I say, unless you've got very tight controls on your environment for them, we suggest that you not go to Leghorns, but that you go to a heavier breed. Barred Rock, as we mentioned, is a very good breed. They're a pretty good egg producer, and they do hold up well. Rhode Island Reds are another breed that hold up well here.
How many breeds of chickens are there?
Must be 10,000. I really don't know how many breeds there are. There are quite a number.
We've got some literature in the studio. This is a really complex topic. Really a lot.
A lot of breeds, and we're seeing new breeds and new crosses coming online all the time.
Uh-huh. Again, depending on what you want for bigger breasts or more meat or
or more
bigger
eggs
or temperature tolerance
or different plumage or whatever.
Longevity.
Mm-hmm. I know one thing that we tried this year with the Rock Cornish crosses. They're birds that are strictly for eating, and they're white birds, and primarily they just eat and eat and eat and eat, and you can kill them within about 8 to 10 weeks, and they can get supposedly up to 15 pounds. Ours were about 9 pounds, I would say, after 10 weeks, and people that have tasted them say that they taste like turkeys. They're real juicy, and, you know, a leg, it doesn't look like a chicken egg. So that's another thing that you can consider if you're not going to winter over in birds.
What was that variety again?
White Cornish rock crosses.
Right.
White Cornish rock crosses. That's the breeding line is
right. Uh-huh.
Mentioned in there.
It's a hybrid, actually.
Okay. Our number for our listening audience is 474-5044. If you have any questions for my guests, or if you have any information or experiences in poultry raising that you would like to share with us, any hints, we'd be happy to have you share them with us. 474-5044. Okay. Peter, how long have you and Helen had poultry? Have you been raising poultry?
We've been raising poultry for about 7 of the 8 years we've been in Alaska.
Why did you decide to? It just, as someone who's not a poultry raiser, it seems so curious to me. This seems like a very difficult place. I mean, Mexico, it seemed very natural. There was just a lot of vegetation and a really mild climate year round, and the chickens seemed to fend for themselves. But I
think poultry is something that you kind of get into through the back door. You get a couple of chickens and have some success with those, and so then the next year you have 20 chickens, and for us, the next year we had 100 chickens, and so it went. But we finally, it got to the point where going out to the chicken yard to feed the chickens when there were 200 chickens was not as pleasant an experience as it had been when there were only 20. They would, literally mob you when you came out with the food. So at that point, we kind of toned down the chicken effort and became. We had been also interested in waterfowl, so we increased our interest in waterfowl and. We now have a few chickens just for eggs, but we're mainly raising ducks and geese.
How many ducks and how many geese do you have?
Well, right now we have 13 geese. That's a little heavy on the geese. We'd like to have a few less of those, and we have about 10 ducks. Basically, what that represents is our basic breeding stock that we carry through the winter, and then we breed those each spring, and they raise clutches of eggs and then hatch goslings and ducklings, and that's our that's where we get our meat birds, and also we give those away or trade them to other people. For example, we have a traditional trade of a goose for a turkey that some neighbors raise.
Uh-huh. Well, that's, they do the turkeys and you do the
right.
geese, and they get a little variety.
Turkeys are harder to raise, but they're easier to pluck.
So it depends on when you want to have
it's like to pluck a goose.
Plucking a goose is a good 2-hour job. Uh-huh. It involves very great strength between your thumb and your first finger, gripping the feathers and pulling them off.
Really?
And there are a lot of feathers. They're hard to get off. We've recently been using duck wax, which is a real good way to get the feathers off faster. And that works a little bit better. But you still have to rough pluck them and get the main
big
feathers out.
Big pin.
We also have been saving the down of all the geese that mm-hmm. we've killed over the years, and I think we have enough to make a small pillow now.
The expense of down pillows is really high, I guess, because there's a lot of down. I had one that my grandmother gave me, and I carried that around. I think I got it when I was about 10, and I had it when I was 24 or 5, and there were just a few feathers in it, and the people that saw that pillow didn't quite appreciate how emotional I felt about it. Uh-huh. But they really do disappear, and it.
The feathers are real, are really nice, and we have very high quality feathers from the geese that are raised in this area. But it takes many, many, many geese to get enough feathers to do anything. The reason that we got geese is sort of a funny story. At the time, we lived near Corella's Corners, and they used to sell livestock at Corella's. And I went down to buy a sheep because I thought it would be fun to raise a lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all out of lambs, and I found out that you only get 2 legs off of a lamb. I wanted to raise lamb so we could get leg of lamb, and I thought, well, if they only had two legs, that really wasn't worth the effort. Right. They happen to have.
They happen this to have is interesting some, to me. I'm just waiting to him tell how we get more than two on a geese. On goose.
Well, they happen to have some geese, so I brought home three geese, and we kept those over the summer, and we were very attached to them. They're lovely pets. Mm-hmm. And they're very responsive birds, much more so than chickens, for example, or ducks. They get very close to people. They're very chivalrous in the way they protect their family and protect their young. And although they have very stereotyped forms of behavior, they also have a lot of diversity in their behavior, a lot of ability to respond to new stimuli. So they're very satisfying animals to raise, and they also are a natural for Alaska. This Alaska is the home of the goose and the duck. Right. This is where they all summer and raise their young, and so the abundant natural feed that we have here is the natural feed for waterfowl. And if you have some property with grass on it or any kind of grazing type material, geese and ducks will do very well on that. And if it's a lawn, they'll keep your lawn nicely clipped, and they can gain weight from just a little feathery gosling up to a 10-pound or 12-pound goose without eating very much else than just
foraging,
grass,
foraging. And what would be the time span for that? If you got a gosling in the spring, mm-hmm. right, how long would it take?
Geese are remarkable in that they make the journey from being a tiny little day-old gosling to ready to fly south in 12 weeks. So
okay.
They're ready. You have to be very careful, because if you kill them at 11 weeks, they have a lot of pin feathers, and about 13 weeks, they'll have a bunch more pin feathers. But right at 12 weeks is a pretty good time. Kind of a narrow window there for.
I see.
Pin feathers make it even more difficult.
We really got into the fine points. This plucking is obviously something that you learn after years of experience. This separates the newcomers to poultry raising from the old-timers when you get into the...
It's hard to be real businesslike about the birds that you've raised yourself, and I think our problem is that we're reluctant to kill them at 12 weeks, 15 weeks, or 20 weeks, and that's why we have 13 right now rather than 7 that we
want. Right. I was going to say, my grandmother used to maze me. She raised geese, and I absolutely agreed with that first little piece that you did as an introduction. The geese used to wander between her house and the outhouse, and they loved her. They really adored her. They would all gather around and seem quite affectionate, but they hated us, or so we thought, and they would fly at our heads, and it was really terrifying. And, of course, we indulged them by being terrified and running and letting them know that they had the best of us. But they're very good watchbirds. They really let you know when a stranger is around.
Yeah, our geese will chirp up, and they'll really let us know if anyone is coming into the yard. They raise quite a clatter, and we have neighbor children who delight in coming over to the house and so on. And if the geese are loose, they'll let us not only let us know that the neighbor kids are there, but they'll get them sort of rounded up a little bit. And so.
Right.
Our geese will make noise before our team of sled dogs. They will squawk much louder. Sometimes a car could go by and our dogs won't even make a noise, but those geese... not supposed to be making noise now.
Well,
chicken.
She wants a little equal time here. This is all this geese talk, and here she is in the studio. Doesn't see any geese.
She was trying to... Okay.
One of the things we found out about geese, our first winter, we didn't think the geese could make it through the winter, so we killed them and ate them, and they were real good. So we learned two things there. One thing was that geese tasted good. It was worth the effort.
Uh-huh.
But... at that time I worked in the emergency room, and I met a woman who lived out on Goldstream Road, and she said, "Oh, you don't have to kill your geese in the winter. I keep mine all year round." And it turns out that geese are very well adapted to the cold. They have a good blanket of down, mm-hmm. and as long as there's no wind, as long as they're protected from wind, and the temperature doesn't get much below 30 below, and you give them fresh water every day, they'll do fine. And so we keep ours outside. They have a little shelter they can go into. They don't naturally like to go into shelters, but when it gets real cold or if it gets windy, they will. And they'll do quite nicely. It's a little bit of a chore carrying fresh water out to them, but they'll actually bathe at 30 below. And last year when we had the cold snap around New Year's, we did have to put them in the garage for a day or so to kind of warm up because there was wind then also. They mm-hmm. can't tolerate wind when it's cold. But if it's just cold, you give them fresh straw, they'll do quite well.
In your shelter, do you have any a light bulb or any
nope,
kind of warmth
at
all?
No.
Nothing at all?
Just it's just a little A-frame that they can walk into to get out of the wind.
Ken, do you have anything to add in terms of what kind of protection you need for...
Not on the geese. I agree with what he said. The folks around town that raise geese do very similar to what he was describing. They'll have a box that they can simply get into with some deep bedding in it, and dry bedding, that's important, and out of the wind, and you're in good shape. Chickens, on the other hand, especially if you're going to try to get them laid during the winter, need a little more protection than that. I was just looking here at one of my smart books I brought with me, and at about 15 degrees above zero, egg production starts to drop off pretty fast. And at about 10 degrees above zero, they start freezing some combs. And so they need more protection than geese do. I've seen several folks, not necessarily here in town, but out in the villages, in the bush villages, that have constructed rather small houses. And the chickens actually heat the building themselves. And, in fact, you've got to have some ventilation in there to get ammonia and some of the moisture out that they put in there through respiration. So it's not terribly expensive, you know, to keep a shelter for them that they can make it through. But you do have to give chickens a little more shelter. And I think the point that he made about fresh water is extremely important, not only with poultry but with any animal during the winter. They'll drink more water than they do in the summer. And so it's really important that you get out there and give it to them a couple of times a day.
Well, that's interesting.
Ken, what about food? Like, what do you recommend for food for chickens and food for geese? Pete was mentioning... Pete was mentioning the foraging, but do they need vitamins? Do they need a supplement if they're just going to be foraging? And what do they do during the winter?
I guess, again, it kind of depends on your goals. With the geese and the ducks, I think it's different, again, than it is chickens because they are a natural forager and a natural grazer. Chickens will forage and they will graze some, too. And if all you're interested in is having them around to look at or whatever, they can do pretty well through the summer without any supplemental feed. On the other hand, if you're interested in a fast weight gain, as you described a while ago, or good solid egg production, then you're going to have to feed those chickens to produce. And after studying it and looking at it and considering, I always recommend that they go to a commercially prepared food. There are a number of them on the market. There are several sources here in town that they can get it. And if you look at a poultry ration, it is so complex and involves so many minute quantities of very small vitamins, you mentioned, minerals, all kinds of things. It's just next to impossible to do a good job of mixing that yourself. And it's just as economical to go buy it from a company who's mixed it in large quantities, I think.
Okay, we have a caller. You're on the air.
Hello, this is Rich Seifert. I thought I'd call up and add fuel to the... fire about the virtues of a goose as a watch goose. Back in medieval times when I was a graduate student, I lived at a homestead out of town, and we had a pair of geese, the gander of which was a big gray, and this fellow was absolutely marvelous watchdog. He absolutely let no one even get out of a car. He didn't want any salespersons or whatever that you were unwillingly... the victim of, he would absolutely fly at a car and keep them from getting out of the car. He was very protective of any other birds, even turkeys that we had around as well.
Huh.
So they can be very entertaining at times, as well as excellent watch geese, but you cannot turn your back on them, because if they're good watch geese, they'll also nip the devil out of you when you turn your back on them because of the protective instincts. And I wondered if you can train a goose to be both without the option that they'll nip you, as well as be very protective and a good watch goose.
I don't know, Ken, do you have some tips on goose
training? No, I don't.
Pete's geese are quite trained, believe me. He might, I don't know.
To do with what you do at an early age?
I think that,
critical period.
The geese are naturally protective of the people that they're used to. And so they don't bother us at all, except there is an exception that during the breeding season when they're laying eggs, then it's a different ball game. They're protecting their nest and their goslings, and their instinct is to hiss and to make threatening gestures at anything. But except for that small period of time, the geese are protective of the people that they grow up around, and so we haven't had really any problem with that. I think there was one goose one time, one gander, that gave us a little bit of trouble, and a friend of ours who lives out in the Salt River picked him up by his neck and gave him a little slap across the bill, and he never bothered any of us again.
Rich, do you have any first-hand knowledge of what kind of damage a goose attack can do?
Oh, yeah, I don't, but my wife got nipped in the back of the calf, and it leaves a nice little mark.
Uh-huh.
It's a black and blue mark. It's a bruise kind of a thing. But the goose was so clever as to actually, if you turn on him and you knew he was flying at you, turn him, he'd actually dive down and faint like he was grazing in the grass, just totally innocent of any attack mode. But as soon as you turn your back, he'd be at you again. So he's sort of like a dog in that regard. If you face him, he won't get you. But if you turn your back, he'll come at you.
But it requires courage.
He was just a really nasty fellow, very good watch goose.
Geese will are very well equipped to fight, and they have special bony prominences on the elbow of their wing that they can hit you with. And what their tactic is usually is to grab you with their bill and hold you. They actually pull you up closer to them, and then they beat you with their wing while they're twisting their bill. And so they can inflict quite a substantial injury. Our dogs, at one time or another, our three dogs have been attacked by the geese, and they really give them a wide berth. They don't bother them at all because of that. They really learn their lesson. And I think I've seen several times where an unsuspecting dog was attacked by the goose and really surprised, left with the tail between their legs.
That's interesting. Helen, do you have something to...
Well, the thing about sort of backing away from them. In the springtime, when they get that aggressive, I always just back away when I want to leave. I don't turn around and leave myself exposed.
So they have some real sense of your face and your back. It's not just the movement, the direction. Rich, how many geese do you have?
Don't have any now. This was a previous experience. But, I agree with eye contact. It's just like any creature. Eye contact is very important. If you look them in the eye, you just can't handle it. Anytime you look away, he'll just do what he needs to do. So,
also, if you shake your finger at him, sometimes he'll also go away.
If that don't work, try a ball bat.
I carry a broom.
Why would that work? I don't just that it's a signal of some sort for them.
I think that probably it's sort of very similar to another goose bill, and if you're sort of coming at them with something that looks like a goose bill, they sort of may feel that they're being threatened themselves.
All righty. Keep
that
in mind.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Rich.
Thank you.
Yeah.
While we got you on the line, I don't know if you guys know it. Rich is our energy specialist with Co-op Extension Service, also seeker of truth. I think the people ought to know that, Rich. Rich, I sometimes get questions on solar poultry houses and whatnot. I know I've kind of got you off guard here, but do you want to offer any comments to folks on that?
I once saw a wonderful little thing in the New Yorker magazine in which George Booth did a series of cartoons on how to stay warm. And one of his recommendations was to take a boot and make a little pouch at the top in which you could put a chicken on top of each foot. And he called it chicken shoes and just made a comment that they were very warm. I've heard that actually chickens and solar and a combination of recycling chicken waste has been tried in Ruby, in fact. And a lady was producing commercially eggs to be sold locally there and was doing quite successfully with that mode. Generally, it's just like any other solar application. It's more seasonal here than other places. But it certainly could be useful in the summer.
We heat our chicken coop actually with chicken waste. That's what I've done is constructed a dropping pit underneath the chickens. They're up on wire, and we have now several years accumulation of the droppings in this pit. But the dropping pits represent the concentrated manure from the chickens, and it gives off a lot of heat. And that's
just what is happening. It's just it's fallen down and it's drying.
It's a fermentation process.
Sort of like a composting process.
Right. Uh-huh. I think so. But it's very rich in nitrates, and somehow that adds a little zing to it. But this is in the context of a double I made a double insulated chicken house with styrofoam insulation, and so it has a readiness to hold heat. And I think if that dropping pit ever froze, we would lose that advantage. It has to stay up to a certain temperature.
That's exactly it. With all the composting processes, any anaerobic or aerobic process, the warmer you keep it, the better it will be. Mm-hmm. Every 10 degrees Fahrenheit, you increase the temperature, you double the metabolic rate.
So
the warmer you keep it, the solar can be just as useful in keeping the compost warm as it is to keeping the chickens warm.
And then the composting process will continue itself.
I think that the only problem is that it smells bad, but you get used to that.
Do you have any ammonia and methane buildup in there that causes any problems?
It just smells bad, yeah. But it doesn't. I mean, it's never lit.
Mostly in the spring when it's temperature's warming up a bit.
Do you get used to the smell of that? I mean, my experience with cows is after a while it can become somewhat pleasurable, a warm barn, but with chickens it doesn't seem that way.
No, I don't think it ever becomes truly pleasurable. I think it's just something that you put up with.
Uh-huh. Tolerate for the joy of...
Right, of the eggs.
Of the eggs.
One of the real problems that we've had with chickens that I think you have to, just to speak about chickens, that you have to be real careful of, is that chickens, when they're in confinement, they need to have a certain number of hours of daylight or hours of artificial light. It's about 14 hours that they need. And when they're in confinement, you have to be very careful how closely they're packed, because they get what are called vices. And several of the vices they get, one of them is egg eating, another one is feather picking, and they can literally cannibalize other chickens if they're packed too tight, or if they get bad habits.
Okay.
So you have to be real careful of that. They need, I think, 3 to 5 square feet per bird is, I think, the recommended limit. And there are various salves and things you can put on. If they start pecking at one of the birds, you can put on to diffuse their interest.
Chicken repellent.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the egg-eating business, you have to hide the eggs. You have to have a place they can go that's dark where they can
lay
the eggs and get away from the other chickens. Otherwise, they'll start pecking their eggs.
And that is where the phrase pecking order comes from, presumably?
Well, the pecking order represents the part about pecking the other chickens, but the term egg on your face, I think, has something to do with birds that eat their own eggs. And then if you find a chicken with egg on its face, then that's the chicken that needs to go out and cease its laying career.
I want to get caught with egg on your face. Some chickens just prefer the laying boxes, but I know that my grandmother had chickens that were sort of renegades, that were annoying to her, that would get out of the fence or prefer to lay just anywhere, which, of course, they can get broken because other chickens. Is that some kind of nutritional deficiency, or is that just a preference of some chickens? Or?
Well, I've noticed with our birds that it just amazes me that when they're little and it's the first time that they're laying, that they actually know where to lay. I mean, sometimes it may take them a week, but they'll start laying in the roosts. I mean, they'll know just instinctively where to lay. And I don't really know. Maybe Ken or Peter would know, or Helen.
Well, I think that the problem with the chickens that go over the fence, and believe me, you know, as you've pointed out, they'll go to tremendous extremes to get out away from the regular place to lay their eggs, and that's just a natural thing. They're hiding their nest. It's a normal instinctual behavior among birds to lay your eggs in an inaccessible place. A lot of times you'll have a hen that just disappears, and about 23 days later she'll come back with a little group of chicks following her, and that's just a normal bird type behavior pattern to hide a nest and then be able to successfully raise the babies.
Now this may seem like a very silly question to all of you poultry raisers out there. Is there an advantage to having a rooster in the roost, because then you have to candle eggs to make sure which ones are fertilized and which ones aren't? I mean, it doesn't matter to me, but of course, to a lot of people, it mattered. They do not like fertilized eggs. And so then I remember all my relatives going through this elaborate candling process, and the kids, if they get to be 7 and 8, have to spend an hour each after school candling eggs. Was there an advantage to having roosters around if you're not trying to raise broods?
Not to my knowledge. They're not. I don't think it increases or decreases production dramatically.
It tends to, you know, I spoke a little bit about the vices uh-huh. that chickens have, and it seems like that if there's a rooster there, that the chickens are more content, and they're less likely to have vices. but that's really the only thing. Now, when you spent all that time candling eggs, the reason was that you were trying, probably part of the problem was that you were trying to sell these eggs commercially.
Yes, they sell them.
And the standards that people have for commercial-grade eggs are much, much different than what a family would have, for example, for uh-huh. their own consumption. So we never candle eggs, and we used to sell eggs to people, and nobody ever bothered to candle them. And actually, people will pay extra nowadays to get fertilized eggs over unfertilized.
That extra bit of protein.
Right.
I think what they're looking for more often than not with candling is our blood spots mm-hmm. in right. the eggs, which, again, don't hurt the eggs as far as flavor or anything else, but it's a little bit disconcerting to break one and have a blood spot, and I think that's what they're looking for.
It's a little fussy because we love rare meat, and right. that's right. perfectly appropriate. People send steaks back when they're not rare enough, and yet you get a little... Mm-hmm. The other thing is what developed, it seemed, in the I don't know actually when it happened, this taste for pale yolked eggs. My grandmother was really aghast at some of the eggs that you'd buy in the stores where the chickens hadn't been out and allowed to forage for grass and so on, and they'd get these sort of pale eggs, and she liked a nice orange yolk and said it tasted better. But very often people in towns or cities really don't like an orange yolk. Does that depend on the kind of chicken, or is that what they're eating?
It's what people get used to. Chickens that you raise for meat at home tend to taste different than those you buy out of the store do. They tend to be a little tougher, for one thing. The dark meat tends to be a little darker very often, and those of us who are raised on that kind of chicken prefer it, or did prefer it. I have now eaten chicken out of the store long enough that I like that better than I do the other. So it's the same thing with eggs. You know, it's kind of what you get used to.
I'll never forget the story they told about when, back in the old days of Alaska, all the eggs were brought in by ship, and they were 3 to 4 months old or older when they got to the various villages and towns on the barges. And when they first started flying eggs to places like Galena and Tanana, people didn't like the fresh eggs because they didn't have any good taste. You know, so.
Aged eggs. Well, they have 1,000-year-old eggs in China, right? I mean, it's not really.
So.
It's not really. What do they call 100-year-old eggs? It's mm-hmm. it's a pickling process. I think that they go through, and I don't believe they're that old. Although, please, if there's someone in the audience, please call us 474-5044 if you know for a fact they're 100 years old. Maybe.
I might mention. You know, we were speaking about feed. In our situation with the ducks and geese, when we winter them over, basically we're just trying to keep them static. We're not trying to get any eggs out of them. They're not breeding during that time. They're just basically we're trying to meet their nutritional needs for a period of time when they're just staying pretty much status quo. So actually what we've been very successful with is chunked dog food, and they really like that.
Large dried
chunks. Uh-huh. And we get it at a local feed store, and the geese love it, and they eat it up every day. And it has very good nutritional qualities because it has to for mm-hmm. the needs of dogs, and it meets the needs of the geese during the wintertime. The one thing that is very important with waterfowl have bacteria that grow in their gastrointestinal tract that aid in their nutrition. In other words, it helps bind and absorb various vitamins and minerals. So any feeds with antibiotics in them are really out. You can kill a goose or a duck by giving them feeds that contain antibiotics.
Because it destroys their own natural...
The bacteria.
Bacteria.
Right. So if you do buy commercial feeds, you should take the time to check, and it'll have a W/O, meaning without, if it's without antibiotics, and usually it'll say W or with tetracycline or something like that if it does have antibiotics.
Why would they put antibiotics in feed?
Certain feeds do need it. Like, I know turkeys are turkeys. We've got to get, when they're little, they're supposed to have feeds. Maybe Ken knows why.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of diseases that, need to be controlled, and especially just beginning a new bunch of young chicks or even a new bunch of young poults. Coccidiosis, for instance, is one that can just run rampant through a flock very quickly, and that happens to stem from a organism that also lives in the gut of, in fact, all animals. And it's there all the time. It needs to be there in very small numbers. What happens with coccidiosis is that there's a dramatic change in environment or feed or what have you that creates a stress condition, and you all of a sudden get an explosion of that coccidia population, and they give off a toxin, and it's a toxin actually that kills the birds. And so we use sulfa drugs to control coccidiosis. We also use tetracycline and some of these others.
Poultry diseases are highly contagious.
Well, they're contagious to poultry.
That's what I mean. So that
actually are contagious to humans, but very few.
But that's what I mean. When one of the birds is affected,
Yeah, you can lose a number of birds pretty quickly. One of the things about waterfowl that really attracted us to them is that waterfowl are inherently very hardy. Chickens have been so bred through the ages, and there have been so many derivative breeds made from the original. Probably the original chicken was the jungle fowl of Asia. And from that, all of the chickens that we have today, including, you know, a great many different varieties and different sizes and shapes, even little tiny chickens called bantams and so on, have come. However, geese and ducks are relatively stable in their genetic makeup, and you don't see great diversity from the original parent stock. And they also have a great hardiness and a resistance to disease. So that's one of the things that's very nice about waterfowl. They very, very seldom get sick. When they do, it's usually a result of a dog attack or some other unfortunate accident that's happened rather than any inherent illness.
One thing I've noticed, too, with the geese, unlike the chickens, they'll hatch their own eggs. And maybe the chickens will, too, but I just haven't seen ours ever do it. And Helen, I know, has been really instrumental in their leg. You actually have an incubator for your... Could you tell us about that? How they hatch, or what the cycle is, anyway, for the geese and their eggs?
Oh, you mean like the length? It takes a month. It takes 30 days for them to actually hatch. And if you have an incubator, you have to play Mother Goose or Mother Chicken if you're doing chickens, and you have to turn the eggs several times a day, and actually cool them a little bit too. The normal mothering instinct is she gets off to get a little bit of water, this sort of a thing, and then goes back on. So she's off the nest for 15, 20 minutes and goes back on. So you need to cool them yourself.
So you really have to reproduce the nesting experience for the egg.
And so day in and day out for...
One of the problems we see up here with people who incubate eggs, our climate is so dry that the eggs will actually dehydrate to the point that they won't hatch sometimes. And so
you need to water them as well.
Sometimes you can use a spritzer bottle, or you can just take them out and dip them in a pan of water and put them back in.
Because those are actually sort of meat-breathing membranes. I mean, it seems...
Yeah, the eggshell actually looks like a pretty impervious structure, but it's not really. It's full of holes.
Okay, we have a... caller here. I won't keep hanging on. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I was just wanted to call and tell you how much I appreciate your program.
Well,
sounds like
you.
A real good, interesting subject matter here.
Thank you. Are you a poultry enthusiast?
Yes, definitely.
Yes? How many chickens, geese, ducks do you have?
Too many.
How many?
Oh, probably about 8 or 9 geese and 15 ducks and a dozen chickens, give or take a few.
So you agree that they're habit forming?
Oh, yeah. Most satisfying. Good hobby, and plus they're good for freezer fodder in the fall time.
I was talking to a woman today, and she said they're a very good family experience. It's something that even small children can become involved with and participate in some ways, and that's a really good...
Oh, yeah, it's right up there with Sesame Street. It's good good entertainment and educational for them, even when you have to pluck them.
Right. Well, that's good. A little work and some understanding of where the food on the table is coming from. I think that's
right.
Really valuable for children. We get real divorced from the process of what it takes to feed ourselves.
And if you do it right, you got better food too.
Right. The taste is better. Do you have any special tricks or hints to poultry raising that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, that's why I called. I was going to tell you that the way I heat my chickens is with my ducks and geese. You keep them up higher in the room, in the barn type of stuff there. My birds don't have any heat except what they produce. And I keep the chickens up in higher pens, and therefore the ducks and the geese keep them warmer than the rest. Although the daylight is a definite factor in the egg laying all winter, without good lighting, you can quit trying to get eggs all winter because they just don't lay once it gets dark.
Is there some direct correlation between, is it the harder conditions, Ken, or is it in fact a daylight
I suspect thing it's more a daylight thing than it is the harsh conditions.
Right.
Yeah, they have to think that it's springtime. The natural instinct of a bird is to lay eggs in the spring, and so you have to reproduce that by giving them about 14 hours of daylight. That's the point where they start to lay. It's really interesting that the first chicken to lay 250 eggs a year was happened in 1901 or 1902. The first chicken to lay 300 eggs in a year was in about 1920. It's only a recent development that we have chickens that lay an egg a day. In grandmother's time, and great-grandmother's time, the chickens lived in the barn, and they laid the eggs in the spring. You know, it's very unusual to find eggs, you know, any other time of the year.
Oh, really? That's of
so
course, that makes perfect sense.
It's giving them the control conditions and the special feeds and the dietary things that Ken was talking about, the breeding special birds that are selected for egg production. All of that has happened in the last in this century.
Yes, definitely.
That's
I feed my birds mostly just Delta barley, either rolled or unrolled, and in the wintertime I mix it in, depending on the temperature, with cracked corn. I don't give them any commercial feed at all, except in the springtime when the sun starts coming out, I tend to get everybody started with some of that Laena, mix that in with their feed.
Do you soak your barley?
No, but I make sure they get plenty of water with it.
Uh-huh. Some people feel that if you soak the barley in hot water, you get a better, better digestion by the bird.
Well, you probably would. You probably would. It'd probably be a real good idea. I just don't go to that much trouble with them in the wintertime.
It's one more step to go through.
Yeah, in the summertime, I'll throw their feed in their water pan, especially with the ducks and the geese, because it gives them something to do fishing it out, and they enjoy eating it out of the water. But in the wintertime, I had to devise a special water so that they could only get their heads in there to drink, because they kept getting in the water and trying to bathe and freezing up, and I'd have to keep thawing them out, so... If you keep them dry, that's the main thing.
Yeah, there's the one thing that's real important on that is that ducks and geese both, neither of them have the ability to make tears. And so in order to keep their eyes working, to keep them from getting what's called sticky eyes, you have to have water adequate for them to get at least their eyes and most of their head into the water.
Right.
Oh, that's interesting.
I just modified a big plastic garbage can with slits in it so all they can get is their head and their neck in. You put about 5 gallons on the bottom of that every day. And then they can't get their whole body in there.
One other thing about ducks and geese, particularly, is that if they do get sick or if they get wounded by a dog, their natural tendency is to not eat, and they'll just starve to death
right.
when they're wounded. So
once they go down, it's hard to get them going again.
Yeah, one of the tips that is now being put forward for that, and which has worked very well for us when we've had sick geese, is to tube feed them. And basically what is involved is using a small diameter tube that you put down into their gullet, and it's pretty simple to do. You just hold their head and pass it down into their mouth cavity, then giving them special feed just through the tube. And that works very well to keep them going, and it'll actually make the difference between life and death in a bird. But they have this unusual instinct to just stop eating, and they'll just die if you don't feed them.
That's really interesting. It's just sort of give up, not an attempt to continue on, because some animals actually go to great lengths to survive even when they're severely wounded.
Poultry. Well, that's about all I had to say. Well, I just wanted to participate here a little bit.
Thank you very much.
Let people know that raising your own critters like that is most satisfying, especially once you get them in the freezer. And if you should be lucky enough to have little ones hatch out, that's even the better. But when you can crack a goose egg or blow a goose egg out, fill up your whole frying pan and make a quiche out of one egg, that's pretty satisfying.
And tastes good, too. Thank you very much for calling.
Good night.
Good night. Again, our number, audience, is 474-5044. 474-5044. If you have anything to add or any questions for our guests in the studio, please call. Well, can you...
No. I'm sorry.
Or Peter, that's right.
One of the things about geese, there's two distinct kinds of geese. Some geese have knobs on their bill, on the upper bill, and some geese don't. The geese with the knobs are derived from the African swan goose. And I think, in my personal opinion, that's an inferior goose. It's a goose that is not as well adapted to our climate. And I don't think they're as intelligent and as friendly, nice to get along with. But there are two geese in that category that are seen. There's one kind called the African, another kind called Chinese geese. And actually, I'm sure that they are. It's a matter of personal preference.
Right.
The other line of geese come from the gray-lag goose of Europe, and it's very close relative of the white-fronted goose that we see here. And those geese are the barnyard-type geese, the gray goose, mother goose type goose, called also the Toulouse, and then the Emdens, which are the white geese you see. Those geese tend to be larger and some say much more ferocious. But anyway, those are the kind of geese that we raise. We raise the gray goose called a Toulouse.
Toulouse. I have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah. I was going to call, but then I thought, well, I might as well just listen, but... there was a comment made about the geese when they starve, and they used a tube to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
The French do that just to fatten fowl.
That's right, to make foie gras.
Yeah, I don't have a good memory as far as just what they call it, but I know that they definitely do that.
The famous French liver pâté, and they do that to make larger livers.
Yeah, they force feed them, actually, is what they do.
They do more than that. They used to do more than that before we became a little more humane about the whole thing. They used to nail their feet to the floor to eliminate all exercise, and then they'd force feed them, and you really get fat livers.
I see. Well, I wasn't familiar with that, but I was familiar with them using tubes and holding them. I've seen pictures of it and stuff like that. But and I just called to say I appreciate the program. It's my type of program.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
I have a good time, too. Is there any special food that you have to feed that causes the liver to get bigger? Is it something that the goose just in general is larger, so the liver is larger, or is it especially? Ken, can you?
I don't know that I can answer that totally. The object, of course, was to create a very heavy liver and a very fat liver, and so... Feeds that tend to do that, that are high in fats and high in energy, would, of course, help that situation. Poultry have a pretty unique digestive tract compared to any other animals, I guess, on the face of the earth, really. They don't really have a stomach as we think of it. They have a little compartment there where gastric juices actually enter the tract, but it doesn't hold any quantity of food at all. And then you get into a gizzard, which is a truly unique mechanism as in digestive tracts. And, in fact, they have measured the strength of gizzards like in wild turkeys, and they say it's adequate to crack a small hickory nut. And I don't know how many are familiar with small hickory nuts, but it takes 400 pounds per square inch of pressure to crack one, so you wouldn't want your finger stuck in a gizzard of a wild turkey. And then they have the compartment that Pete referred to a while ago. Actually, they have two. Called a cecum, and they have two of them, and I'm never sure whether it's cecums or ceci, but at any rate, they have two compartments, and those act as fermentation chambers, as he mentioned a while ago, where bacteria and other organisms help to digest the food. The other very unique thing about poultry GI tracts is that the urine and the fecal matter actually get combined within the tract before they're expelled from the body, and that's different than any other animal, too.
Oh, very interesting. And what's a craw?
craw is nothing more than a sack that holds a whole bunch of food until the digestive tract is ready to take it. It's just a storage.
So a storage pouch, like a squirrel putting some food
right,
in there.
Right.
But do they have to have little gravel in the craw? Or
yeah, that's kind of important, and that's something that should be mentioned, that we ought to keep grit or gravel or sand around, something to put down that gizzard, because as the chicken goes along, of course, some of that gets swept out of the gizzard with the food as in the natural process, and so it has to be rejuvenated occasionally.
How would you do that, Ken, if you had, like, we've got our ducks and geese and turkeys and chickens all together. How would you just put out down on the bottom of the chicken coop floor with the gravel? We have gravel, and during the summer it's not a problem, but can you just throw it on the ground?
You could.
I mean, the geese won't eat it or anything? Or?
Oh, I think they'll all pick some of it up because they all need it. Oh. At home, when I was a kid, we had a little self-feeder, a little container that we kept full of grit, and when they needed it, they went over there and got it.
Huh. So just like the water in the feed, you could just put in the grit.
Sure. Right.
I wonder if that expression, sticks in my craw, comes from poultry users.
Probably does.
Yeah. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling. I don't know if you can answer this. I didn't catch the beginning of the show, but I've had a pheasant around the house for a few weeks, about 4 weeks maybe. And I've been feeding them Delta barley and cabbage, and he came because there was a garden outside, and he was eating all the old, everything that was left in the garden, even after it got cold. And I was wondering if you have any suggestions on what else I could feed him, or do you think that he's going to be able to survive when it gets really cold? It's been kind of cold, and he's still around.
Are you out in the North Pole area by any chance?
No, I'm not. I'm in the Fairbanks area.
Hmm. There are some pheasants that a gentleman out in the North Pole area raises, and he turns a bunch loose every winter, and some of those actually do survive. Even in pheasant country, pheasants don't live to be very old. 3-4 years old is a pretty old pheasant, and a lot of them don't make it through the first winter even there. I think he has a fair chance of surviving if you can keep him dry and keep if we don't have any ice that gets on his nostrils to where he suffocates. I might suggest that you pick up a piece of soot at the supermarket or out of McKee's or someplace and put that out there for him. I think he'll puck around on that quite a little bit. Any kind of bird seed would be good for him. In the wild, of course, they'll eat, you know, any seed that they can get to, grass seed or even seeds from trees or whatever.
Well, they winter through Kansas winters, and those can be
pretty severe.
Very severe. You put that wind chill on. Is that any additional questions?
Yeah, well, he has a 30 by 40 foot willow and alder thicket that he's been staying in, and he comes out like once a day, and it's about 50 feet from the garden. And he's been staying in there. Do you think that that's I don't have a house for him or anything or any kind of shelter, but he seems to like it in there.
My guess is that he'll be more content there than he would be if you try to construct a shelter for him.
Okay. And the Delta barley, do you think that'll be okay? I was thinking if I soaked it, I heard you say if you soak it, it's better for digestion.
I don't think that'll work for him because that'll immediately freeze into a hard ball. Pheasants have the ability, which makes them wonderful for up here, that they'll eat snow for their liquid. At least they seem to be able to get along without having fresh water. That's kind of unique for a bird up here. So I'd just give him the regular barley. If he's eating it, that would be good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Bye. Hello?
Hello. Hi. I want to just get in on the act on the goose.
All right.
My grandfather was a New Orleans judge before the year 1900. My father remembers that he would take a goose and tie him on a short leash, and then for Christmas time would feed him wine-soaked grain for a period of 3 or 4 weeks until the poor goose could barely waddle, and then that would be the Christmas goose.
Wonderful. Did it improve the flavor?
In flavor, indeed. I'll
pre-marinated
say.
Goose.
That's right. Pre-marinated goose. So I just wanted to pass that little tidbit on.
Okay, for all you goose right. Yes, I want to give my guests all a chance to say some last things. Peter, you have...
Well, I just wanted to mention that a good source of information on geese and ducks is a book by Rick and Gail Luttman, which is published by the Rodale Press, and it's called Ducks and Geese in Your Backyard. It's a sequel to their very, very popular book called Chickens in Your Backyard, and it's just full of little tidbits of knowledge that'll make any goose raiser feel more comfortable with what they're doing. I also brought a book for a person who might want to delve into some of goose behavior. Konrad Lorenz is a famous German scientist, an ethnologist who studied the geese very extensively, and he has a very nice book called Year of the Grey-Lag Goose, which is available in the local bookstores.
He has a wonderful story. I don't know which book this is in by Lorenz, where the geese come in every afternoon and have tea with his father and stand around on the oriental carpet. Do you have geese, sir, in Fairbanks?
No, sure don't, but I thought of that Christmas goose sure had me going.
It's a mouth-watering idea.
Right.
I want to give Ken a few minutes to mention something that's coming up.
Yeah, right. I kind of blackmailed you when you called and asked if I would help do this program. I said, yeah, if you let me put a plug in for Ag Symposium. The 6th Annual Agricultural Symposium will be happening this Friday and Saturday. It's here on campus, in fact, right above where we are now in the auditorium in the Fine Arts Building. There is included 4 meals, which involves 2 luncheons, a banquet, and a farmer's breakfast. We have Senator Pappy Moss, who is one of our luncheon speakers. The governor will be speaking on Saturday and hopefully announcing his new ag program. Friday night, we have a very special banquet speaker. His name is Dr. Baxter Black. He's a veterinarian from Brighton, Colorado. He's a humorist and a syndicated columnist that writes about livestock in very funny ways, and it should be a real good time.
Well, good. Would you give us a number where people can call for more information?
Sure. They can call conferences and institutes who are handling the registration. That number is 474-7800.
Okay. Anyone interested in the Ag Conference, 474-7800. Anything else that my guests would like to add, Sue?
I'd like to give just one final comment. The Cooperative Extension Service has always been extremely helpful. If you have a question that you need answers, like how many birds you should start with and things like that, so I'd recommend that you call them. I've had really good cooperation from them.
Certainly, Ken seems to be a veritable fountain of information.
A worthless information sometimes.
No, it sounds like you have a lot of experience. Well, I'm encouraged. I think maybe next spring I'll go out and get some.
I have some that, if you'd like one, I have.
I'll give you a couple of chickens. I've got 2 geese that I just can't kill. So
okay, there you go, listening audience. It sounds like it's easy in Fairbanks to get into the poultry business. It seems to be an addicting pastime and one that has a lot of experts in Fairbanks, so there's no end of help. This has been very educational for me. I really appreciate it. You can winter them over, and I thank you all for coming. My guests in the studio have been Peter and Helen Marshall, Sue Corte, and Ken Krieg from the Cooperative Extension Service. And would you give us the Cooperative Extension Service number in case they want to call you with some questions?
Yeah, I'll give you 2 numbers. The local office in Fairbanks resides down at Sportsman's Mall. That number is 452-1530. My number is 474-6357.
Sort of a hard one. You have to
think about
that.
I don't call it often.
Well, this has been a very interesting welcome back to Fairbanks. I'm feeling better about being back already. Next week, I want to encourage our listeners to call in and share with us ways of celebrating Christmas in Fairbanks. I had some interesting experiences in Mexico and in terms of the way they celebrate Christmas. Please share that with me. I already have a couple of letters on with recipes and suggestions, so that will be our program next week. And then after that, we hope to talk to some quilters. So keep the home fires burning. It's a little chilly out there, and thank you for joining us.
In a little country schoolhouse where the children used to go, there lived a little fellow by the name of Ragtime Joe. One day the teacher called the class to spell a certain sort of a bird. The kind of bird, it was a chicken, and he could not spell the word. So the teacher called on Ragtime Joe to spell that word for them. He did not hesitate a bit, this is the way that he began.
See,
that's the way to begin.
H,
that's next letter in.